For the moment, we're going to pretend we're not in this room. It's a nice room, no complaints about the room itself, but we're going to imagine that we're in a place that's in a drought right now. It's a very hot, dry, dusty sort of place. There's famine at times. Sometimes there's peace, and sometimes there's war, sometimes battles going on around us. We're in the sort of place where armies might just surround where we're at. A time when that would happen. We're also being transported not just a place, but a time. And there's fear among the people. But not enough fear to push people to turn to God. Maybe for more than maybe a few months or a few years. And then they decide that, well, everything's fine now. We're going to turn to the book of Judges. The book of Judges details the time when God's people were in this sort of situation, where there were times of drought, there were times of famine, all kinds of difficulties, persecution by the enemies of God's people that surrounded them. In Judges 13, verse 1, it says, "Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years." So that's the situation that we find God's people in. Now, how many of you have ever been to a desert? I'm just curious. I've been to a couple of deserts. We had a couple of people. This place that they're talking about now is a desert. It's a very dry, dusty place, and sometimes it helps me to be able to picture places that I've been, maybe even imagine the sounds, or well, the sounds, but also the smells. Deserts, sometimes they smell very fresh and clean, very dry. Some of the plants around you can smell them, and the air is just, it's different. Unless there's a lot of goats around, that's, we'll talk about that, but there's a lot of goats, it changes the situation there. But here we have God's people, the nation of Israel, waiting deliverance as they're in the hands of their enemies. And they're struggling daily. And there's one family in particular, we're going to look at their story here today. A husband and a wife from the tribe of Dan, they worked quietly, building their home. And they wondered what the next few years would mean for them. They had no children. They had no son to pass an inheritance onto. They had no daughters to marry off. It was just the two of them on their land as they worked. And they wondered, would their efforts to build a home just go to nothing? Would this be it? We'll live out our lives here and there's nothing. No family to pass on the things that we know. And they wondered, had God forgotten us? Just like they had forgotten his ways. Now, they still remember that he existed, but they'd forgotten his ways. One day, as the wife of this man, Manoah, we have his name, we don't have her name. She was out working, and the husband Manoah was somewhere else working. The angel of the Lord appeared to her, and he brought with him promises of deliverance. He brought with him hope through a child that she would conceive and bear. Judges 13, verse 4. Now therefore, these are the instructions here that the angel of the Lord brings to this woman. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat anything unclean. Maybe that kind of seemed strange to her. But here was this being. She didn't exactly know who this was. Not really. There was this being that was standing before her. It didn't quite look like a regular man. Giving her these interesting, strange instructions. Verse 5, "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." There she has hope. Hope as a mother. Hope as one of God's people. Of deliverance. As I mentioned, the woman didn't know who this was standing before her. It was a stranger giving her these strange instructions, and she ran to tell her husband about the conversation. She didn't know that it was not just an angel, but actually the Word of God standing before her. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, before he was named Jesus Christ, before we understood that as a name, before he came as a human being, he was standing there giving her these instructions. And as she's listening, she's being told to keep herself set apart for the sake of this child, who would also be set apart, this deliverer who God would provide for his people. And Manoah, and we see, we don't know his understanding or his wife's understanding of God, of their relationship with God exactly, but we do know that Manoah prayed. He was a praying man. At least he knew that he needed to pray to God to help understand. He asked that God would again send this divine messenger to them to help them, to teach them how they were supposed to raise this special child, because they wanted to make sure if this child is being given to us for a special purpose, let's make sure that we do it the right way. Let's raise him up the right way. And God heard this man's words here, verse 9. And God listened, it says, to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So again, the angel of God, this messenger, comes to the woman. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, "Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me." I don't know why she just left him there, standing there, but she did. She ran to go see her husband. Of course, you know, this messenger, he's not too worried about that. He knows what's going on. He knows her heart. They knew, and Manoah and this woman knew, that raising a child would take great effort. They'd never done it before, but they knew it would take great effort. And ideally, it's a team effort. We see that teamwork here exhibited by these parents here. They are going to work together. The husband is interested in how he is supposed to help raise this child as well. A husband and wife are a team. That's the way that God has designed the family to work. They're a team. And we see that in this particular family, seeking God's way in the way that they understand at that point, rather than trying to raise this child their own way. Now, I'm sure what they were being asked to do was unique in that time of Israel. Most of the people around them, and even they themselves, did what was right in their own eyes. Now, that doesn't mean everybody in that nation at that time didn't have a relationship with God, but most didn't. Verse 11, so Manoah arose and followed his wife. So he's going to come hear these instructions from God. When he came to the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" And he said, "I am." Now this might actually be a sort of a clue as to who this was, evidence of who they were talking to. We know that "I am" is a name for God. Now, I don't know if this particular phrase is the same as that "I am," but we have a few hints as to who this is that they're speaking to, that it's not just some angelic being that's been sent as a messenger. Verse 12, Manoah said, "Now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" He's thinking maybe he's going to be a great prophet, like the prophets of old. Surely God has something special for him to do. So the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe." So she has to live a certain way of life that's different than everybody else around her for the sake of this child. I'd imagine Manoah would also have to probably live this way. And we'll get into more of these details later as to what they're talking about specifically. Now let's continue on here, and we have more clues, as more evidence as to who this is that they're talking to. And this is important for us to read and understand. Verse 15, "Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, 'Please let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you.'" They want to feed him. They are hospitable. I think this is something that's unique about this part of the world. Regardless of what kind of famine they were in, what kind of pestilence, whatever else was going on, even in times of war, they still maintained this sense of hospitality. It was part of how they lived. And so they were hospitable to strangers. Verse 16, "And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, 'Though you detain me, I will not eat your food, but if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer an offering, or offer it to the Lord.' For Manoah did not know he was the angel, or the messenger." This word angel could also be translated as messenger. That's what the word angel means anyway. Verse 17, "Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, 'What is your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?'" Here's another clue that this wasn't just some angelic being. An angel, we've seen in other places, when people try to worship them, they say, no, don't worship me. I'm just one of your fellow servants. As angels, you know, that's what they are. They're servants of God. Well, this messenger of the Lord doesn't say that. "And the angel of the Lord said to him, 'Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?'" Here's another clue here. What's one of the names for Jesus Christ that we find in Isaiah? Wonderful. Now, this isn't the precise Hebrew word that's mentioned in Isaiah chapter 9, but it's related. It's almost the same. Wonderful, something that's amazing. Here, that's one of the names for Jesus Christ. Isaiah 9 verse 6 mentions that. His name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace, Father. But that's one of the names for Jesus Christ. Verse 19, "So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground." That's when they knew who this really was. This was God. Not in the flesh, but presenting himself as a man here before them, talking to them. Verse 21, "When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord, the messenger of God. And Manoah said to his wife, 'We shall surely die because we have seen God.'" Finally, they knew who this was. They'd seen God. Of course, they'd seen the Son of God. Now, the wife in her wisdom here, wives have a great deal of wisdom for husbands to listen to. "But his wife said to him, 'If the Lord has desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time.'" They were being asked to set themselves apart, to live a different way of life, not just so that they could see God and die, but for a purpose that God had, to raise up this child. And that child would become a deliverer for the people. Now, we're going to save the rest of this story for a little bit later. We know at this point their lives begin to change. You guys already know the name of the child that was born. You know his story, but we're going to go through some of it anyway. It's a good story. Their lives began to change. They had been set apart for a special purpose. The wife, most especially, she was asked to take on certain conditions of a special vow. Now, the husband wasn't, but the wife was, because she was to raise this child, to carry this child, and give birth to this child, and the child will be raised under those same conditions of a special vow. And they would teach him how he was supposed to live his life. Now, the vow that this chapter, this story refers to, is called the Nazarite vow. The Nazarite vow is not just some simple promise meant for anyone and everyone to take. It's not required by God to take this special vow. It's something that, as we'll read, if somebody decides to take it, there are certain conditions to follow under this vow. But it's not just a simple promise, but a difficult vow for a period of time. Not a specific period of time, but a period of time nonetheless. And it takes commitment to keep a vow. If we take it seriously, if a person takes this special vow seriously. Now, if somebody took on this vow, they would set for themselves a certain amount of time devoted to working on their relationship, their bond, their commitment with God, and committing themselves as a servant to God. And we can think of it as sort of in the way that we think of fasting outside of the Day of Atonement. God only commands us to fast one day a year. But we're told that we can fast other times. We can set aside a period of time for ourselves to go without food and without water for a period of time to help us work on our relationship, to draw closer to our God. So it's similar in that way, although it's probably a longer period of time than a day or two. I think the longest I've heard of somebody fasting was 3 days, and you get to the end of that third day, and that's when you start running out of water really quickly. I don't have any recommendations as to how many days somebody should fast, but we know the limitations that God has given us in these physical bodies. And we can only go about 3 days without water. There's a rule of threes that apply to survival. It's like, what is it? 3 minutes without air, three days without water, it's 3 hours in harsh conditions, and then, what is it, it's about 3 weeks, is that right, for food? Yeah, so these rule of threes, it's a general rule. Anyway, that's a side note. Let's look at this Nazarite vow. Let's look at the details of this vow in Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6, this is the vow that the wife and her child are being asked to take in their lives. Now, generally, this vow wasn't put on somebody except in special circumstances. And we have a few of those circumstances in the Bible. Number 6, in verse 1 of number 6, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, When either a man or woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to the Lord." So this is the premise behind it. The vow of a Nazarite, and that word Nazarite has to do with something that's consecrated, that's set apart. "He shall separate himself, or she, from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine, nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh grapes or raisins, so nothing to do with grapes whatsoever, and you know, not even any alcohol or even vinegar that's similar to alcohol. Verse 4, "All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin." So these specifications here, a special vow, not that it's wrong to eat grapes, but if you're going to take this vow, this is how God wants you to take this vow. Verse 5, "All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head." So that's another element of that vow. "Until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy, consecrated, set apart. Then he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body." Here's another condition. And this refers to dead family members. Just like priests, when they were ceremonially clean or wanted to stay that way, they couldn't go near a dead body. But if they did, they'd be unclean. They couldn't go worship at the tabernacle or the temple until evening or until they washed. But if somebody under this vow went near a dead body for whatever reason, then their vow would be over. That would be the end of this vow. "He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother, for his brother or sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head." So it's a very serious vow. Even if somebody close to them died, they couldn't go to that funeral. They couldn't go and touch them, to hold their hand. Nothing like that. They couldn't prepare the body. Otherwise, they would have to end that vow at that time. All the days of his separation, he shall be holy to the Lord. There's that word holy again. We're going to talk more about that word later. And if anyone dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. So we see that once that vow is over, the person is supposed to shave their head. They offer special offerings to God that they had planned to do. And that vow is finished. That time period is over, even if it ended early. That's how the Nazirite vow works. Now let's turn to Luke chapter 1. We have a few examples in the New Testament of people under this vow, or quite possibly under this vow. It isn't entirely specified, but we see some similarities in the way that they were asked to live. Certain elements of this vow are mentioned in Luke chapter 1, verse 15. This is talking about John the Baptist. Scott Ashley always calls him John the Baptizer, because that's what he did. He was a baptizer. Verse 15, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. So it's very similar to this Nazirite vow. Now, we're not told if John had to keep his hair long, but we do know that he kind of had that look, you know, out in the desert, kind of gruff looking, you know. Maybe he had long hair. We're not told that detail. But he was under a special vow. And it says he will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. Now, it doesn't say that his mother had to take that vow, but she had to raise him to take that vow. That was part of his calling, his special purpose. You can write in your notes Matthew 11, verse 18, where Jesus mentions John. He came neither eating nor drinking. You know, there were certain things that he didn't eat and didn't drink, and people called him, or said that he had a demon. And we know that Jesus was not under the Nazirite vow, because he ate grapes and drank wine. He came eating and drinking, and then people blamed him for having a demon as well, working for Satan. Now in Acts chapter 18, we will turn over to the book of Acts. So that last one, we had Luke 1 verse 15 and Matthew 11 verse 18. In the book of Acts, in chapter 18 of Acts, we see that the apostle Paul took some kind of vow, and we presume this to be the Nazirite vow, and we'll see why here in a minute. Verse 18 of Acts chapter 18, so Paul still remained a good while. So he's traveling between areas, and sometimes he stays in one place longer than another. It says, then he took leave of the brethren. It says that he was traveling from Corinth to Antioch. He took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria. And Priscilla and Aquila were with him. And here it says he had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. So the apostle Paul had taken this vow here, and he had his hair cut off. So we see that for a time, he set himself apart for, you know, a period to draw close to God. In Acts chapter 21, we see that Paul is meeting some people here, and this is interesting because here we have people who think that Paul is teaching people not to follow the laws of God. Now, he told them that they no longer had to be circumcised, but the rest of the law, aside from the, you know, the sacrifices that are done away with, is still supposed to be kept. And we see here Paul is teaching people that, and they see that when they meet him. But we find some individuals who have taken a vow. Verse 21, or chapter 21, verse 23, it says, therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them, and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, and that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. So they're learning about Paul. They're listening to his teachings rather than just listening to hearsay about him. But here we have some individuals who, for a time, took a special vow. And they obviously didn't know about Jesus Christ yet, because they were going to make a sacrifice and then shave their heads and end that vow. And there's one detail in this Nazirite vow, or one detail that's not included in this Nazirite vow, I should say. We're gonna pay attention to for a minute. But it was mentioned specifically to Manoah and his wife. It was clear instruction, along with the fact that the wife wasn't supposed to take of any wine or grapes or strong drink. They were instructed not to eat anything unclean. Now, a person taking the Nazirite vow on their own would have already known that. They would have already been following those instructions because they were God's people. This is a vow that God's people could take from the nation of Israel, God's special holy people set aside for his holy purpose. But during the time of the judges, the Israelites became laxed when it came to keeping God's commands. And they weren't, probably, at least in some cases, they weren't watching out for what they ate. They weren't avoiding these unclean animals. They were in desperate times. Now, that's no excuse, but that's the excuse that they used. They were in desperate times. And maybe we can assume that this family, although they prayed to God, there were certain things that they weren't following. They weren't setting themselves apart in this special way by avoiding unclean foods. Now this command, we'll read this command from God in Leviticus 11. This isn't only meant for just people taking a Nazirite vow. Let's turn to Leviticus 11. This is meant for all of God's people, all through time. Anyone and everyone who God calls to be set apart from the world, to be holy, he asks them to refrain from eating unclean meats as a symbol of that commitment to God. For the rest of their lives, in fact, a lifelong vow, as it were. Leviticus 11, verse 44. Let me find the right chapter here. We're not going to read through the whole list of these different unclean animals. It's all in there. I will point out that in some places the creeping things are re-emphasized. I don't know why. Maybe it was too tempting for people to eat creeping things. I don't understand it. I've eaten a few grasshoppers in my life, but those are clean. That's about it. And only because I know that they're clean. In verse 44, "For I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves. Set yourselves apart as different. And you shall be holy. For I am holy." We're supposed to be like God. When he calls us to become like him. "Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy. For I am holy. This is the law of the animals and the birds and every living creature that moves in the waters and every creature that creeps on the earth, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten." And this stands for all time. And there's continuity with this command as well. When we see that we're going to read a prophecy in Isaiah, a prophecy about the time right before the return of Jesus Christ. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 66. And we see one way that God identifies those who are his is by looking at those who have consecrated themselves to him, set themselves apart to him in his very special and unique way. Some parts of the world, it's very unique not to eat creeping things. Some places, they eat all kinds of things. In Malawi, did we ever tell you about the rats on a stick? Lena has pictures somewhere. We didn't taste them. We've never seen anybody eat them. But we saw them being sold in different places. I don't know. I'm done talking about that for now. Isaiah 66. We see in this prophecy that people have a choice to make. And it's purposeful. Isaiah 66 in verse 15, it says, "For behold, the Lord will come with fire." So this is a time of judgment on the earth. "And with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with the flames of fire." This is serious judgment on the earth, that, a place where people are deceived, where they They turn against God. They don't acknowledge him. We live in this world. We try to be different than this world. Verse 16, for by fire and by his sword the Lord will judge all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. Verse 17, those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens after an idol in the midst. So this is talking about purposefully sanctifying themselves against God for an idol instead. And included in this is eating swine's flesh and the abomination of the mouse. Those nice, you know, rat kebabs that we saw in Malawi shall be consumed together, says the Lord. So those that worship idols and those that is part of worshiping other gods, eating animals that God says are unclean is all part of this. And this is one of the aspects of what God is looking for in his people. In the end times, he's looking around to see who has committed themselves to me, even in difficult times, even in times of drought and famine when food is difficult to come by. Are they going out and finding these creeping things just to keep them alive? Or are they consecrating themselves to me, he says. That's not an exact quote. And when we choose to follow God's laws, and this is a choice for us, everything that God asks us to do is a choice. We could say no. Of course, we know there's consequences for that ultimately, but this is a choice. When we choose to follow God's laws, even the law of clean and unclean meats, we choose to acknowledge God's authority over us in our life. We choose to acknowledge the fact that God has created everything that exists and that he knows his creation and he knows what's best for us, even on a physical level, but most especially on a spiritual level. Now, this isn't just about physical health. There are people who have eaten all kinds of things and lived very long, very fulfilling lives. But it's more about spiritual health. It's about a connection and a commitment to God. When we choose to follow even this, what some people might see, might think of as a simple command, and we choose to acknowledge God's authority over us, and God's authority to specify what it means to be holy, what things are holy, what it means to be set apart for his purposes. Now, this word holy, that's translated as holy in different places all through Scripture, there's one primary word for it in Hebrew. It's kadosh. Kadosh. I have it spelled here Q-A-D-O-W-S-H. This is from Jacinius's Hebrew Chaldee lexicon that specifies what this word means. It expounds on it a little bit. It says that this word holy, or kadosh in Hebrew, means pure, clean, free from defilement of crimes. When we think about our sins, when we sin, we don't have those sins cleansed. When we're not cleansed from our sins, we aren't free from the defilement of crimes. Sins are crimes against God. It also talks about free from the defilement of idolatry and other unclean and profane things. Now in the Greek, the word that's translated as holy is hagios. H-A-G-I-O-S, hagios. This comes from Thayer's Greek lexicon, where it specifies that this word hagios means, you know, it can refer to something that's worthy of veneration, worthy of worship. Now, you know, we're not worthy of worship, but our God is, and he's holy, and his presence in us makes us holy. It also specifies of things which on account of some connection with God possess a certain distinction and claim to reverence. And this is referring to places that are sacred to God, places that God has said are holy, which are not to be profaned. It also specifies of persons whose service God employs, persons whose services God employs. And God calls us holy. He's saying, I have bought your services. I have bought your life, your way of life. You've become mine. And when we accept that call, we accept that fact. It also continues on here, set apart for God, to be, as it were, exclusively his. We are exclusively God's people. We're holy. And goes on to talk about sacrifices and offerings, moral cleanliness, moral in a moral sense, sinless, upright, holy. Let's go back to that couple in Judges. Judges chapter 13. Judges 13, we're going to jump back into this story where this family is asked by God to set themselves apart for a special purpose. And it might have seemed strange, the people around them who were still eating unclean things. And it might have seemed strange to their neighbors that they didn't grow grapes. I'd imagine they didn't grow grapes. They didn't eat grapes. They didn't drink wine or any kind of alcohol. They were different. But it was for a purpose. Verse 24 of Judges 13, we'll pick up right where we left off. It says, so the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew and the Lord blessed him. And the spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahanah Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. This is somewhere in the central region of the country of Israel. And we don't have all of the details of his childhood, but we'd imagine that Samson's parents taught him how to live from a young age, how to live his life under this Nazarite vow that he was supposed to take on from the time he was born. Actually, even before he was born, through his mother. And I'm sure there was a time where he followed these instructions on his own after his parents were, or after he was old enough. He had to, you know, take this upon himself. And there was probably a time where he truly believed that God had set him apart as holy to do God's services, set him apart from his peers, from those around him. But as sometimes happens with people, especially if they've been given some great ability, pride crept in to Samson. And he began to believe that his strength came from within himself rather than from God. Now, the first time that we see Samson begin to disregard his vow is in Judges chapter 14. We'll read some of this here. This is where he starts to disregard his vow. And I'm not sure if he exactly breaks his vow, but he's starting to do things that are not quite right. What people who are supposed to refrain from unclean things shouldn't do. Judges 14, verse 5. So Samson, here he's searching for a wife. Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. Now, this might have been the first time that he saw his own strength. This is the first time we read about it. And maybe this was the turning point for him in seeing his abilities and thinking, wow, I'm so strong. Look at me. Look at the things that I can do. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. I've never torn apart a young goat, but it sounds like it's easier than tearing apart a lion. Though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. He hides it. And verse 7, then he went down and he talked with the woman, and she pleased him. He wanted to marry her. Although she wasn't part of the Israelites, she was a Philistine. God was using this situation for his purposes. Verse 8, after some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And here we see he starts disregarding his vow. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. Now, it wasn't wrong for him to eat honey. But where does he get this honey from? He gets it from the body, the dead carcass of an unclean animal. Surely something that he wasn't supposed to do. And he doesn't tell anybody about it. He took some of it in his hands and went along eating. When he came to his father and mother, he even gave some to them. His mother, especially, we know, was under this vow. And she probably wasn't supposed to eat anything that was produced from an unclean animal's carcass. And here he gives it to her as well. So he's disregarding his vow. At some point, Samson became more and more arrogant. We see that through the stories here. We're not going to read through all of his story, too many details. But God, for a while, continued to give him strength. He wasn't yet finished with Samson. And that's probably the reason that God maintained that strength, because we see Samson not living a very, what we would say, a Christian way of life. Not a holy way of life. He starts to think of himself as invincible, and he forgets that his strength doesn't come from himself, but from God. And God would continue to give him that strength as long as Samson maintained that commitment to the work of God. And that commitment is shown by the keeping of this lifelong vow that he's asked to do. Of course, we see that commitment start to break down. And in his arrogance, Samson at one point gives up the most obvious part of his vow. The most obvious part. The one that definitely should have set him apart, at least outwardly, so that everybody could see, hey, this guy has long hair. Not everybody else has long hair, especially among his people. This guy's different. Judges 16. Now Samson went to Gaza. And here he does something that is not befitting one of God's people. He saw a harlot there and went into her. When the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They're gonna snag him. And then we see this great feat of strength that he does. Verse 3, Samson lay low until midnight, then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts. And these aren't just, you know, some simple door. This is a giant wooden gate of a city. And he takes two of them and he lifts them up, puts them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of a hill as if it was nothing. So we see the strength that God had given Samson. And then afterwards, does he go and fulfill his purpose to go and take vengeance upon the enemies of God's people? No, he doesn't. He gets distracted by a pretty lady. And this lady isn't really interested in him. She plays along. She's bribed by these Philistine leaders, the lords of the Philistines. In verse 5, it says that they went and they bribed her. And so in verse 6, Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. Excuse me. I brought this water up here for a reason. Now for a minute, it seems that he's still committed. He doesn't give away the secrets to this vow. Although he's not doing the work that God has for him to do. Eventually, after several tries and failures to overtake him, Delilah again pleads with him. Now look at this pleading here in verse 15. Then she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? Now that's some straight manipulation right there. You have mocked me these three times and have not told me where your great strength lies. If you love me, you would do this for me. You would tell me all your secrets. Now, you should have figured it out by now. This lady didn't really love him. She just wanted his secrets to overtake him. But he's thinking, well, I'm strong. Nobody can get me down. Nobody can overtake me. I am so mighty. That's what he's thinking, most likely. I wish we could peer into his mind. And so, he tells her his secrets. It came to pass in verse 16. When she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death. He just couldn't handle it anymore. That he told her all his heart and said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me and I shall become weak and be like any other man. He gives up that vow at that moment. He gives it up. He severs that connection with God that was made through this vow. He no longer cared about the work that God had asked him to do, that he had known from the time he was a child. And of course, the lords of the Philistines, they come in at night when he's sleeping, they bind him, they cut his hair and then they bind him and they take him away. Samson, he didn't he didn't continue to set himself apart as holy, someone God had chosen for this work. He broke his vow first in his heart and then outwardly through his actions. He gave up that designation of holy, of set apart. He turned to his own purposes, his own desires, rather than serving God. Now, thankfully, his story wasn't over yet. God still had purpose for him in his life. Excuse me. Verse 21. Here, the Philistines, they took him, they put his eyes out, and they brought him down to Gaza. This is probably, it sounds like one of their main cities, maybe one of their capital cities. And they bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. Maybe grinding grain, something like that. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. Now, at the same time, as his hair is growing back, this outward sign of his commitment to God, he's rethinking his life. He's rethinking his decisions. He's rethinking that commitment to God that he had made since he was born. Excuse me. Gotta stop drinking so much water. Verse 23, now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god. So this big festival, they're going to sacrifice a sacrifice and to rejoice. And they said, our gods have delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. They're happy about this. They have their prisoner. The people saw him. They praised their god, for they said, our god has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land and the one who multiplied our dead. So it happened when their hearts were merry that they said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. So they called for Samson from the prison. And he performed for them. And they stationed him between the pillars of this building. Excuse me, sorry. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. About 3,000 men and women. Lots of them. And we see God's plan in this situation starting to take form. They were on the roof watching while Samson performed. And he's down there holding her, standing against the pillars that are holding up this great structure. And then we see, finally, the very last, Samson turns to God. He realizes where his strength really came from. Samson called to the Lord, verse 28, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray. Just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. That wasn't just for his eyes. God had purposes in this, in delivering his people from this nation that was oppressing them. Verse 29, and Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one in his right and the other on his left. Then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that were killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. See, once he finally realized where his strength came from, once he finally realized that it was from God, he was doing God's purposes, then God used him for the purpose that he had set him apart for. He finally fulfilled his calling. He finally fulfilled his calling. Now that's the end of the story of Samson. He's dead, he's buried, he's given a good burial, honored in his death by his family. Excuse me. And now we turn to us. We have to think of ourselves in this, otherwise this story has no purpose. We have been called by God to set ourselves apart as special, as holy to Him. One aspect of that calling is, of course, the clean and unclean meats. We're supposed to refrain from unclean foods as an outward and inward show of our commitment to God. And that's also symbolic of sin of any kind. It's a constant reminder for us. And sometimes we stand apart as different. I know growing up, there were certain foods, you know, some of my friends ate or at school. They always had pepperoni pizza, and it always looked so good. All my friends were eating it, and I had to pass it by, and I forget what else they had. Not as tasty, definitely not as tasty, the food that I had to eat at school. And so I was different from my friends. They didn't do that. My friends ate whatever they wanted. But I had to watch out. I was different. And when we choose to answer that calling from God, we choose to make a lifelong vow to God for the rest of our lives to commit ourselves to Him in every way, by following His commands, every single one of them, by living a different way of life, by changing even our minds, our attitudes. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We have a few more scriptures here. Try not to go all day. Some of that food is starting to smell pretty good back there. It's all clean. We can eat it. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Verse 19. It says, "For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God." Wait a second, what did I say? Okay. I see it now. Verse 16. That was a good verse, though. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16. "Do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" So it's God's presence in us that actually makes us holy. We are a dwelling place for God. "If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are." Now this refers to the fact that we have to maintain this holy temple, maintain that commitment, that connection with God. And also, God protects us from our enemies. If anyone goes up against the temple to defile it, God will protect us from our enemies. Now chapter 6. Now this is really verse 19 here. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19. "Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, which is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own?" When God dwells in us, after we've been forgiven, we've been bought with a price, we are not our own. We give up that right to own our own bodies and our own minds. We become God's. "For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." In other words, in everything that we do, in our entire lives, we glorify God. We maintain that lifelong vow to God in everything that we do. A few more verses here as we're talking about this cleanliness of our bodies. We're supposed to change how we live. We also change our minds. We change our focus. We get rid of sin. Let's turn to James chapter 1, verse 27. I mentioned one verse here. James chapter 1, verse 27. Very famous verse that we often quote. It says, "Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble," so to watch out for others who are in need, to take care of their needs, "and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." To keep oneself holy, set apart from the world. Out of sin, giving up sin, committed to that vow. Romans 12 now. Romans 12, we read these verses earlier. Let's read just the first two verses of Romans 12. Verse 1, Romans 12, it says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." Just like the animal sacrifices had to be of clean animals. Well, the living sacrifices that we are, we have to be clean. We have to be holy. We have to maintain that holiness, that calling, that connection with God, that lifelong vow. "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed, not only on the outside, but by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." We change that way of thinking. Let me give you a few verses here that you can look up. 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 16 talks about us girding up the loins of our mind, preparing our minds because we are holy. We commit ourselves to God. We are holy just as He is holy. 1 Peter 2, and write this one in your notes as well. 1 Peter 2, verses 9 and 10 talk about the fact that we are a chosen generation, royal priesthood, holy to God for His special purposes. We were once not a people, but now we are people who have obtained mercy. And we're going to turn to a few scriptures in Revelation. Just like that verse in Isaiah, that prophecy of the end time. Here we have some prophecies of the end time in Revelation chapter 12. We see how God's people are identified. And a description of His people. Verse 12, or chapter 12, verse 17. So here we have this word picture here, this description of the dragon. That serpent of old, enraged with the woman, was representative of God's people. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So there we have an identification of God's people as those who keep the commandments of God and know who Jesus Christ is. Committed themselves to Him. Chapter 19 of Revelation. Chapter 19, verse 8. Verse 8 says, "And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen." This is an outward picture of the inward, clean and bright. "For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints, keeping themselves unspotted from the world." Holy, the righteous acts of the saints, living a way of life that is pleasing to God. Verse 14 talks about this again. "And the armies of heaven clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses." One more verse here, chapter 20 and verse 6. We see our special purpose. We're called now for a purpose now, to be God's people now. But we have a purpose in the future that we're preparing for now. "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection." We're God's first fruits. We're called now to be holy. "Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. That's part of our purpose, to be priests, to be kings, to be teachers, leaders, of those who God will call in the future. We've been set apart now to fulfill that purpose. And we have to maintain that commitment, submitting ourselves to God in our lives. We choose to dedicate our lives to Him by taking a lifelong vow, like Samson was asked to, although not the Nazarite vow, but a vow to commit ourselves to God in every way, to refrain from sin. One aspect of that is refraining from unclean meats, as God has instructed us. And in every way, we refrain from unclean things. If we begin to see ourselves that way now, as holy, as special, as set apart by God, and acknowledge His power, then He's going to give us that strength to be able to live up to our potential, to be used by Him in very powerful ways, in important ways, both now in this present time and in the future.